Well, I dare say if we knew it was going to be taking place at the foot of that mountain, we would probably do anything we could to avoid it. It wasn't a pleasant scene. This man that brings his son to Jesus' disciple, his own father calls him a lunatic. He's so possessed by demons that he falls into convulsions and seizures as the demon tries to throw him either into water or fire to drown or burn him. Mark tells us in his gospel that this boy could not talk, that he would stiffen up straight as a board, that he would grind his teeth, that he would have these fits. Luke gives the further detail that when the demon is mauling him, that this boy would be screaming at the top of his lungs, and it would scarcely leave him alone. This is horrid. Awful. And to make it all worse, the disciples proved to be of no help to the situation. A hopeless situation that they felt helpless to change. Now, with that scene in our mind, let's remember what took place right before the story that we've read. You see, Jesus has just come down off the top of this mountain. He was up there with three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John. And you'll remember that this is called the Mount of Transfiguration, for it was there that God, for a moment, unveiled Jesus. He allowed these three disciples to see the fullness of Christ's glory. Or at least a glimpse, I should say, of that glory. People who were saints of old spoke to him in the form of Moses and Elijah. God spoke to his Son from heaven. And Jesus radiated with the brightness of the sun. And it was such a dazzling sight. These disciples didn't know really what to do, and they didn't want to leave. They said, let's pitch some tents and stay up here for a while. But they couldn't do that. Jesus said, we've got to go back down this mountain. And just in that movement, from being on that mountain full of the glory of God, to coming down to this horrible situation, was an object lesson for the disciples. Another reminder to them that Jesus, the Son of God, the highest and glory, and the ones upon whom angels state their adoration, has come to this earth and has become willing to enter into the very pits of despair that human beings find themselves in. And he's taking his disciples right into that with him. And notice his response when he comes into this scene with this boy convulsing before him, the small crowd watching around, and his disciples, so to speak, off to the side, twiddling their thumbs, wringing their hands, not sure of what they should do. Notice in verse 17 that he turns his attention his disciples. It seems, at least at the surface, that he is maybe more concerned about his disciples' spiritual illness than he is with that of this boy suffering before him. Because he gives strong medicine to them. You unbelieving and perverted generations. Think what that word means. Perverted. You would not like to be called perverted. Yeah, that's what he says to his disciples. And it's disgusting to him, and it's so disgusting, he says, how long shall I be with you? That's what we want to do around perverts. We want to get away from them. And Jesus is speaking in that kind of language. How long shall I put up with you? This situation is highly displeasing to the Lord. And the Lord doesn't stop here. It's not recorded in Matthew, but over in Mark, the Father is involved. And the Father, as Jesus begins to ask Him how long the Son has been this way, He tells Him since childhood, which would indicate that this boy is probably on the verge of adulthood. So this has been going on. He's either in his late teens or his early manhood. But this has been going on through his lifetime. And then the Father, unfortunately, says more than perhaps He should have, because He says to the Lord, "But if You can do anything, take pity on us and help us." And the Lord stops Him and He says, "If I can. If I can. All things are possible to him who believes." And the Father responds in the way that His disciples should respond. "I believe. Help my unbelief. I believe. Help my unbelief." And that's what the story's about. Faith is the issue here. A living faith in Christ is the crux of the matter. And that becomes clear when the scene is done, when the boy is healed, and the disciples are away from the crowd, and they can ask Jesus privately, "Lord, why could we not cast this demon out?" And He gives them the clear answer. It's because of the littleness of your faith. If you'd only had faith as a mustard seed, you could have done this. You could have accomplished this. I want to pause there and remind you that throughout this world, in our generation, what we sang about in the first psalm of this service is happening. God is doing wonderful, mighty works across the face of this earth. If you're in our Sunday school class this morning, you saw a missionary going around the western coast of Africa, seeing God convert and change and do incredible things. Seeing a pastor go into a Muslim city and ask the elders if he can start a church there, and them agreeing for him to do so. That's incredible. Incredible working of God. I was talking to Jerry O'Neill this past week as he came to attend the service over in Lafayette, and he was just explaining his recent trip to China again. And the incredible work of the Lord over there as He is opening up wonderful opportunities. And thousands are turning away from the blindness of communism and atheism unto the Lord. The people who our forefathers in the faith went over there and ministered to, their descendants, remembering that and wanting to reunite with their brothers across the ocean. That is a mighty, mighty work of God. And what will be our faith when we are older? When we're sitting in a retirement home and looking and reflecting back over our life, will we be able to say what the psalmist did? "So now when I am old and gray, O God, forsake me not. Until Thy strength and power I have each generation taught. For God, Thy righteousness extends into infinity, and Thou hast wrought such miracles. O God, who is like Thee?" Will that be our faith when we're older, marveling over what we have witnessed in our lifetime and telling our children and grandchildren to expect the same? Christ is the power that we lack. And as believers in Jesus, our faith must be a growing faith. If we're children of God, we're also children of Abraham. And we're told in the Scriptures that Abraham's faith grew. That he didn't walk in unbelief, but he grew strong in faith, being fully assured that what God had promised, he was able also to perform. And we can encounter difficulties and impossible situations around us. And God has placed us in those situations for this very purpose, that our faith will grow and be developed by God. And that's really the tender mercy of the Lord in the hard providences that we face. That God would be growing our faith in His power and His ability. Rutherford said, "Doubtings are your sins, but they are Christ's drugs and ingredients that the physician makes use of in curing your pride." And the reason that we don't trust the Lord enough ultimately always comes back to that. It's our own pride, our own desire to do these things, our own thoughts that we think that maybe God's not going to work here, instead of trusting and calling upon the name of the Lord. And back in verse 20, you'll notice that he says, "If you have the faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain." And that was a mountain to be moved. This young boy with a demon. It's a sizable object, a demon. You don't enter into battle lightly with a demon. And he said to this mountain, "Move from here to there. Move this demon out of this boy's life. And it will move. Nothing will be impossible to you." And we talk about having faith that moves mountains, and it's proverbial. And there's a sense of that here, but I want you to reflect again on the stories and how they link together. Because remember, he says, notice how he says it in verse 20. He says, "You will say not to a mountain, but to this mountain." It's the mountain that they're at the foot of. It's the mountain of transfiguration. The mountain of glory. And what his disciples had just witnessed was the glory of God coming down from that mountain and coming and entering into this impossible situation and shining and radiating there right in the midst of all that brokenness. Christ was glorified. Christ brought healing. Christ brought His power right in their midst. And He's saying, if you'll have faith, if you will trust Me, you will see this work in your midst. We've got to yearn for it. That's what faith does, is it yearns to see God. It yearns to experience Christ. And when we're in these impossible situations, where we're in despair, when the waves are crashing over us, God wants us at those times and in those places, of all times and all places, to exercise and grow in our faith and cry out to Him like it says in the 20th Psalm, "Help from your holy temple send, and strength give us from Zion's hill. God, from your heavenly mount, come down and visit your people." Do you yearn for that? It's easy as believers to say that we do. It really is, isn't it? Oh, I long to see God work. Oh, I want to see God work. But does your lifestyle really exhibit that? Are you doing the things that we see people in the Bible doing and see God in the Bible calling them to do in order to see Him work? The primary of which is verse 21. It's the answer here tonight. This kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting. Fasting puts the heart and the hunger that is needed in our praying. And that's why I wanted to start this series on prayer with this idea of fasting. It's a difficult discipline for Western Christians. We are plump. We are comfortable. We're well fed. We have every convenience all around us. And you are constantly being urged away from the means of grace into the means of comfort. And fasting is a way to break it, to break the world's hold on you so that you can give yourself to the Lord in prayer. The Lord is waiting for Mount Zion, looking down, as the scriptures say, His eyes are just roving to and fro across the face of the earth to see those hearts that are completely His. And there's our problem, see? This is where our faith has to grow. We have to give our heart more to God. We've got to yearn more for God. We've got to hunger more for the Lord. And fasting helps us to do so. Bunyan said, "It is better to go to God with a heart empty of words than to go to Him with words empty of heart." He wants our hearts. And fasting helps us to turn our hearts more heavenward, more toward God. And I don't want to make you feel guilty tonight or proud. Guilty for your lack of fasting, or proud because you do it. What I hope just help you with this evening, through this meditation, is just a greater yearning. And I want to give you reasons that Christians should fast that will hopefully provide a greater earnestness to do so. Just four of them quickly here. Remember that Jesus presumed that His disciples would fast. It's just a kind of an assumption here. Guys, things get hard. You can't do what you want to do and think you should be able to do. Then what would the Scriptures show you to do? You fast and you pray. That's just part of the Christian experience. When He's instructing in the Sermon on the Mount, His disciples on the issue of fasting, He says, He doesn't say, "If you fast, don't put on a gloomy face." He says, "Whenever you fast, do so." He assumes that His disciples will fast. Now, there was a time when His disciples were not fasting, and the Pharisees came and asked, "Why aren't they fasting?" And He said, "Well, because the bridegroom's with them. But when the bridegroom leaves and the feasting's over, they'll start fasting, longing for Him to come back." And at times where God is pouring Himself out upon us, then there's not that much need to fast because we're experiencing Him. But when we haven't seen it for a time, and we're wanting Him to come, that's when His disciples should fast. It's just part of following Jesus, part of our dying to ourself and giving some of our heart and earnestness back to God. Another reason that will give you some earnestness is fasting is to taste God and His powers. We've been talking about that. We don't do it for fasting's sake alone. We have a desire, a goal in our fasting. John Piper has a wonderful book on it called Hungering for God. And in his book, he says, fasting, Christian fasting, is a hunger for all the fullness of God. Our fasting is to be done because we want to taste God. And nothing else we will say to Him can satisfy us. Thirdly, prayer and fasting helps us to identify with the suffering of others. I wonder if, as Christ looked into the heart of His disciples, that He saw in those hearts as these men were trying to deal with this young man, frustration and more concern over what their failure looked like to the crowd and what their compassion should have been for this young man. And when we fast on behalf of other people,
We are entering into their sufferings in a unique way. And there is a fellowship in that and a joy in that. An inner secret joy that a believer can have as he fasts for someone else who is suffering. And finally, just remember this if you don't remember anything else. Fasting will give you exactly what you want. And there's a promise and a warning in that. Fasting will give you exactly what you want. Jesus said, if you fast in order to be seen by men, then you've already gotten your reward. Why were you fasting? You wanted people to see how spiritual a guy or gal you are. You go around telling people, making it known, and you've fasted, you got what you wanted. That's great. But there's something better, far better, friends. It's to fast in secret. And only God knows your heart. And Jesus says He'll reward you. He'll reward you for what you do. Fast and get exactly what you want. If we want to see mountains move, we must fast and pray. Now here's what I want you to do. I don't want you to start tonight at the fellowship meal. Long ago in our ministry, we had a guy stand at the head of the line, passing out plates, letting everybody else know he was fasting. I don't want you doing that. Rejoice and enjoy each other tonight and eat that good food. But here's what I would like to encourage you to do. God's putting this on your heart. Make an appointment with God this week. You make appointments with one another all the time. Go out for a meal, spend the evening together, to have a date, whatever it may be. To go to the doctor, to run them to sports. You have your life scheduled. And if you want to meet with God, make an appointment. Miss a meal. Turn off your phones. Don't dare have the internet anywhere near you. And talk to God about what's on your heart. And I want us to start at least the praying part of that right now. The way I want us to do our prayer time this evening is rather than sharing requests, I want to ask if someone would first of all just volunteer and start off our time with praying by asking God to just forgive us for our littleness of faith, because it's a common malady of us all. Is there someone who'd be willing to do that, to start off our time of prayer, asking God for more faith and forgiving us for our lack of it? I'd like to ask someone else to just plead with God to work in our midst so that we, our children, can see His mighty answers to prayer. Is there someone who'd be willing to do that? Zachary?